Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. When I was a kid, I had three hobbies: building stuff, breaking stuff, and blowing stuff up. Today, we're talking to a guy who, in a stroke of genius, managed to turn these things into a very successful career. Today on the show, Adam Savage of Mythbusters fame joins us. We'll discuss how following our thrills can lead us to interesting jobs in niches that previously didn't even exist, systems for accomplishing amazing projects, and staying humble while doing it. This episode really helped me wrap my head around mastery of a craft, which is something I've been working on and thinking about a lot lately, and I think you'll get a lot out of this conversation. If you want to know how we managed to get all these great guests, well, I've got a huge network, and it's very deliberate, my creation of that network. I'm going to teach you how to do it for free in our course, 6-Minute Networking, which is at jordanharbinger.com/course. By the way, most of the guests here on the show, they actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter, so come join us. All right, here's Adam Savage. I know you originally wanted to be an actor, and then you found, okay, my drive is not acting. How do you know when something you're doing is not your drive? Because I think a lot of people struggle with that.
None of the decisions I have made in my life were made with the clarity of, this isn't the thing I want to do, that's the thing I want to do. Okay. Or very few decisions were looked at as a cost-benefit analysis of my creativity. I was in the drama club. I found my people in the drama club in junior high school and high school. And theater was really important to me. And as such, my dad knew some people, and a good friend of his was Charlie Kimbrough, who played Jim Dial on Murphy Brown, the newscaster. And Charlie got me my first agent and got me an acting job. And I did a few commercials here and there. And I pursued acting because I liked the idea of being famous when I was 16. Sounded awesome.
Forgivable, yeah.
Yeah, and I was okay at acting, and I went to a Tisch School for the Arts at NYU for 6 months, only to see, I didn't realize it at the time, but what I was witnessing was a tremendous amount of commitment from a lot of people who were interested in the craft, and I wasn't intersecting with it as a craft. I mean, it's a long way of saying, like, by the time I was 19, and I was still doing some auditions here and there, I was like, I'm just not that into this.
Yeah.
So then I just sort of let it go.
You wanted, like, the result of acting, not necessarily to be, like, a good performer.
That is a great way to put it. I thought that being clever was good enough.
Ah.
And I did not know how to find a thing that was worth busting my ass for. And I didn't at all know really how to bust my ass.
Interesting. So you never thought, like, okay, I've got to dive headfirst into this. But then it sounds like, in the book, you say, follow your secret thrills. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like once you find this thing that you're really into, that's where you know, okay, I can bust my ass making this gun over and over.
So I am resistant to describing my path as instructive, even though it is instructive to me.
Yeah.
And there are many people in the world who have a clear idea. I have a niece who knows she wants to be an orthopedic surgeon.
That must
She's
be so
known
nice.
For a long time.
Yeah, that must be nice.
I agree. But for me, it took me a lot of bouncing around in different industries and different things before I realized, and it was very specifically within special effects. So I had bounced around a bunch of different careers, from assistant animator to graphic designer, freelance graphic design. I moved to San Francisco in 1990 and just started working in theater. I worked in about 15 different theaters over 2 or 3 years. And that got me a reputation. And I was having a lot of fun in theater. I was learning a lot. I was learning stuff every week. I was becoming a much better carpenter, scenic painter, rigger, stage manager. I was finding that I liked thinking about a big picture enough that made me valuable to people that were hiring me. And that got the attention of Jamie Heineman, who was running a small TV commercial special effects shop in San Francisco at a place called Colossal Pictures. And so I was about 6 months into working with Jamie on Nike commercials and other small things when I realized, my after-hours life is very different. And what I noticed was when I was working in theater, even when I was working all day long at Berklee Repertory Theater and then heading over to Beach Bunk at Babylon at night to do a shift there, that even when I was doing those long days, I was still coming home and working all night and making sculpture and making things in my art studio all night long. And about six or eight months into working for Jamie, I realized I wasn't doing that anymore. I thought about it and I realized, oh, you know what? I'm getting all of the creative fulfillment that I get from coming home from doing theater work, I'm getting that at the job now.
Yeah.
And it's satisfying me on this really, really important creative level. Now, special effects industry is packed with people who will tell you, who love the phrase or who say the phrase, I used to be an artist.
Hmm.
And being the child of an artist and growing up with the experience of someone who structured their whole life around being able to do this one thing that they had to do, which was paint. There was an importance to me of not saying I used to be an artist. That this was utilizing the same parts of my brain. And so what I realized though that was that this is what a career could be.
Yeah.
And this was the first time that light sort of peeked through a window and I was like, oh, a career is something you're both really good at, but kind of obsessed with all at the same time. And so then I thought, okay, great. I'm not going to say I used to be an artist. I'm just going to put all my energy into this stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you mentioned in the book that this is where your ideas come from, where you start getting engaged with something and passionate about something. We often dismiss that because we think we can't do anything about it. But it does segue nicely into this focused passion or this obsession.
Well, we dismiss it. I dismissed it mm-hmm. certainly because my schoolmates were cruel about my passions, right? So like I was a nerdy kid and the things I liked were nerdy and I didn't share them with my peers because kids can be cruel. And I think middle school and high school is where a lot of people learn to subsume those things.
Sure.
Because our obsessions and the things we can't stop paying attention to, whether it's aliens or fan fiction about Twilight or Dungeons and Dragons or whatever it is, those obsessions make us vulnerable because they reveal us. They're showing people our bellies. And so to me, yeah, a lot of people don't pay heed to those things. And this book is my permission slip that when you do pay heed to those things that tickle at your head that you can't stop paying attention to that I call sacred thrills. In my experience, I found myself in those things.
Yeah.
It was like a secret formula for self-actualization, self-realization.
It's important, I think, because a lot of us do overlook those things deliberately or we dismiss them. Your idea that obsession is a necessary and healthy ingredient, I think, is music to a lot of people's ears, because a lot of us will get obsessed with something and we just think, oh, I shouldn't even like this, or I shouldn't focus so much on this because this is irrational, or nothing's ever going to come out of this. I'm just wasting my time, even though I can't stop thinking about it.
Exactly. So many things don't get started because people think that, what is this worth? What am I going to get out of this? Or is this really, my hobby's weird. Should I really do it?
Yeah.
And the answer is, yeah, you really should. Because, and this is a specific because of this, which is that when you're obsessed with something, and let's say it's cosplay, and you see other people do it, and you're like, I would like to try that. Mm-hmm. Not sure that I should, because it seems kind of weird and kind of freaky. Sure, it might be. In my experience, when I went towards that and started to like assemble a costume, I realized, oh, I have this very specific point of view about the kind of costume I want to wear, about the character, but also about the fidelity to the original. And I want to make this really accurate. And so again, diving into something where it has to fit within parameters that you've given it, that's, in my experience, that's pursuing your excellence. Mm-hmm. That's, I need this to fulfill a thing for me. And I'm not sure what that thing is, but I'm going to go towards it. And when you're going towards something that's important to you, i.e. the stakes are high, the things you're going to confront along the way, your own biases, your own laziness, your venality, your jealousy, the things you're insecure about, that journey of going through that is understanding yourself. It's seeing yourself in a different light.
Sorry. It must be all that whatever blue stuff is on your hand causing an allergic reaction. What is that? What is on your hand?
That?
That's a tattoo, but yeah. There's like a blue paint or something.
Oh, it's a Dicom marking fluid is what it is.
Gotcha.
It is a lacquer that you spray on machine. I was working on some Apollo suit parts before I left the shop today.
Why not? Yeah.
Why not? And when you're shaping aluminum to a specific dimension, you hit it with this blue lacquer and then you scribe in the lines where you want to cut it, and it gives you this hyper accurate cutting border. So anyway, it's called marking fluid, and I always end up with it on my left.
Well, you're marked now accurately. Yeah, I know about the authenticity for the costumes. I read about a suit of aluminum armor, speaking of aluminum, that was like 700 rivets and you wore it to school. And can you take us through that? Cause this is like the portrait of a
obsessed
nerdy
young
maker,
man.
Obsessor guy. Yeah.
And I was really lucky in this story that my parents were the heroes that they were in affording me the time and the space and the encouragement. So in 1981, I was 14 and my dad took me to see Excalibur by John Borman. And it was really, really amazing and transformative experience for me. And it's still an amazing movie. It's super cheesy and yet it earns its emotional stripes. It has some surpassingly weird and great moments in it. But the thing that I was really taken by was the armor. There's over 100 suits of armor in the film of all different stripes. They all are part of the storytelling. They're not necessarily accurate to a specific time and place. They're more narrative devices, and they were all built by a man named Terry English in Cornwall, England, who is, to my mind, one of the best armor designers in movie history. So when I saw that movie when I was 14. That Halloween, I made a suit of armor out of cardboard and wore it with a horse that attached to me with suspenders to high school. And then 2 years later, when I was 16, my dad and I got some roofing aluminum and he taught me how to use a rivet gun. And we made me an aluminum suit of articulated armor.
Wow.
With hinges and everything, and straps. We cut apart suitcases to have straps that could strap it to my body. And I wore it to school and passed out in third period of heat exhaustion from wearing the suit. And that is exactly the portrait of the young, obsessed man. And sadly, that suit of armor got stored in the art room where the following summer, normally like a lot of stuff you left there was left over the summer. And some weird, like, bit of zeal, the principal of the high school went into the art room and threw out everything that was stored there. And so I lost that suit of armor to that summer cleaning.
That's
very upset.
That makes me just kind of, you want to shake that person and be like, you don't realize how much, you've never made anything, huh? You don't like, cause you look at something like that and you go, dang, that took somebody a long, long time.
I totally agree with that. And that guy who did that, he threw out a whole bunch of stuff that I had stored in the art room. And it was very upsetting to me.
Yeah.
Upsetting enough that I don't think I made stuff for another year or so after that. Like,
wow.
I felt so sort of gutted by the loss of all those sculptures.
Yeah, like gut punch. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it just feels like, well, I can't make that stuff again, so what's the point? You lose your motivation. A lot of young guys like myself also would disassemble electronics and blow stuff up all the time. Until now, when you do that, I think they call it the FBI. Back then in the 90s, though, they were like, oh, kids, just don't kill yourself, you know, or anyone else. I assume you were one of those kids, too. But as I got older, I'm like, I'm scared to take apart certain things now. Like, I got shocked by a tube in a television.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I almost died. You know, and my friend almost died. I mean, it was like those tubes and those old TVs, they store a lot of power.
A huge amount of capacitance around the outer rim of a CRT screen.
Yeah, yeah. Vacuum tubes.
Uh-huh.
Like, they were talking,
yeah, they'll dump a lot of electricity into you. It's not pleasant. I've been shocked that way before.
Yeah, it's something you remember. You ever take apart like a camera with a flash too?
Man. Those capacitors are very strong.
That is a lesson that you will not forget. And I remember showing my shop teacher the flash stun gun that I made. And he's like, what happens when you get too much voltage going through that and you kill somebody? And I was like, that's not going to happen. He goes, come bring that to this doorknob over here. And he takes the wires and he hits the doorknob with these two copper wires that I have sticking out of this contraption, and they arc weld immediately to the doorknob.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know how much voltage and heat it takes to instantly liquefy copper and stick it to this doorknob? And I was like, no. And he's like, yeah, he tells me, he's like, this is 1800 degrees, probably a lot more.
Yeah.
Your skin can take like 120 of that and before it starts getting, and I was like, got it. So they put up with that stuff. But like, I got older and I was like, oh, this shit can be dangerous. That just never happened to you.
Oh, no. I realized it could be dangerous. I got hurt by a lot of things I took apart, but there's this, and it's a natural kid impulse to take stuff apart. And it's really important, I think, as a parent to foment that if your kid has the proclivity, because if you take enough things apart, you start to understand how they go back together.
Yeah.
If you start to, it's not a direct lesson, but eventually structure starts to become clear. Like, you open up your tape deck because it doesn't work, as I did, and you look down and there's a fuse. Oh, I didn't know there was a fuse in there, and it's fried. There's a space in there. So I go to the stereo store and I bring it. I'm like, you have one of these? And he's like, wow, yeah, I do. And pop it back in, and I fixed my tape deck, and I was 15, and I was like, I feel really awesome about that. Yeah. Robert Klein, the comedian, used to have this joke about, like, why do we lift the hood of our car when it breaks down? Because we're expecting something to say, fix me, fix me. Like, is there something with a light on it?
Right.
And the answer is, actually, a non-zero portion of the time, there is something obviously wrong with something when you open it up.
Yeah.
And it's totally worth doing. And for those among us who actually fix stuff, I will tell you that one of the great secrets of fixing stuff is, I'd say 7 times out of 10, you can fix something by taking it apart and putting it right back together.
Yeah.
And that somehow just takes care of the issue.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Adam Savage. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by ZipRecruiter. Now, this is one of the biggest challenges of business. That is hiring. Even if you run a small business, hiring's a pain. You run a big business, hiring's a pain. You run a medium-sized business, guess what? Hiring's still a pain. There really was no way to get it done in any sort of efficient way unless you hired someone to hire for you. That's why businesses have recruiting departments. ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan is going to be your hiring department from now on. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, the confusing review process, all that is gone. It's all simplified. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. And then they use matching technology to scan thousands of resumes that normally you would have to scan yourself. And they find people with the right experience. They invite them to apply to your job. And as the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one, spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match, which is nice because there's a lot of signal-to-noise issues when it comes to hiring. They're so effective over at ZipRecruiter that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And a few of you who have tried this have actually emailed me and said, wow, we did find a quality candidate through the site within the first day. That's pretty awesome. I mean, that's a pretty good advertisement, no pun intended, for ZipRecruiter and the quality of service. Jason?
And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan. That's ZipRecruiter.com/JORDAN. ZipRecruiter.com/Jordan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This episode is also sponsored by Skillshare. This has been such a cool little fountain of wisdom. It's an online learning community with thousands of classes covering dozens of creative, hundreds of creative and entrepreneurial skills. There's everything from photography to creative writing to design, productivity, specific pieces of software has been really useful. So whether you want to try something new, you're going to a long time passion project and upgrading your skills a little bit, Skillshare has classes for you. Jen has been diving into this. She keeps getting mad that I mentioned some of the creative stuff because she's also taken accounting stuff in there. She's an accountant, by the way, so it's not just basics. There's some advanced stuff in there. There's also, of course, basics. She learned Adobe Audition, which is audio software. She learned Final Cut Pro and iMovie in there, which is obviously video editing stuff. Lifelong learning has been important to me. It's obviously important to everyone here on the team. And Skillshare is a nice, frankly, really easy and convenient way to get a bunch of knowledge uploaded to your brain in a really convenient way. Jason?
Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for our listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right, Skillshare is offering the Jordan Harbinger Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Harbinger. Again, go to Skillshare.com/Harbinger to start your 2 months now. Skillshare.com/Harbinger. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts from our amazing sponsors and to help keep this show going, visit JordanHarbinger.com/deals. Don't forget we have a worksheet for today's episode so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Adam Savage. That link is in the show notes at JordanHarbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to JordanHarbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means you get all of the latest episodes in your podcast player as they're released, so you don't miss a single thing from the show. Now back to our show with Adam Savage.
You're cleaning gunk off stuff as you put it back in. You're re-soldering things if you're doing stuff like that. You're tightening screws again. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going, oh, that must have plugged in here. Yeah. But that's the thing that came unplugged when you dropped it off.
One imagines, but it's never anything super obvious. And yet you put it back together and you're like, oh, now it works.
Yeah. The problem is when you put it back together and you go, shoot, that was in there somewhere. Now it's on the table.
All those extra parts that Greg Brady left out.
Right. Yeah. Like if it's not a screw, you're probably screwed because there's something that's not going to work. You mentioned that nothing is ever finished. Does that not drive you crazy? Because for me, that's like, I guess I'm a completionist in a way, which is why I identify with your checkbox thing, your obsession with lists and checkboxes. Mm-hmm. But the idea that nothing's ever finished, it makes me like get involuntary sort of chills thinking like, oh crap, something could be unfinished that you're going to work on still. Oh,
it goes back and forth. And some things are totally done. But if it's something I'm really obsessed with, it's always an ongoing process. Like I was making Apollo suit parts for a spacesuit that is effectively done. And anyone looking at it would consider it complete and finished, except there's some parts that are resin and I want to be aluminum. So I'm slowly going back through it and kind of combing through and doing it. It's not to say I don't finish stuff. And as I say in the book, I use deadlines all the time to get stuff to a place where it's wearable or usable or demonstrable. And that's vital because yeah. If I'm left to my own devices, I'll just peter away at the tiniest details forever. And all that being said, yeah, there are some things when I really love them. There's just always something else to some final little detail to add.
You do mention the deadline thing. Do you set deadlines for yourself? Like, okay, this is going until Friday. After that, I'm done.
No, my deadlines are larger than that. It's usually like, I want to finish, actually. So I think a Comic-Con is coming up. What costume should I wear? And if it's one that I'm in the process of completing, I'll be like, great. That'll be the costume I finish in time. And then I work backwards from there and think, okay, these are the days I'm traveling. These are the days I'm in. I have these 5 days that I can put into it. I'm going to need to bring in some help. And then I start to work outwards from there. So it's sure there might be stuff where it's like finish it by Friday, but hopefully I've been looking at the totality of the project and like I know that my due date is my due date and I'll assemble what help and resources I need.
Okay, that makes sense. Because for me, everything I do always feels like even preparing shows like this. All right, read the book. I always read the whole book, watch or read or listen to 5-6 other interviews that the person has done so mm-hmm. I don't just ask them the same crap as everyone else and also that I don't miss something awesome. That's like, wow, this yeah. isn't in the book. But then I'll have like 8 pages of notes. I know I'm not going to get through everything. So then I have to trim stuff. And it's for me, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm running out of time. I'm reviewing this. Like it's always, there's never enough time to finish everything perfectly.
Okay. And that, finishing everything perfectly is totally not the goal for me of a deadline. And it's actually an interesting thing to talk about here because one of the reasons I love deadlines is because it hacks things off your decision tree and it takes things out of your belt. In order to get X done by Friday, as you get closer and closer to Friday, you start having to leave behind things you thought you were going to get done. Okay, so let's say I was making an alien suit for Kane. Oh, okay, I want this kind of communication. And you know what? I'm not going to get that done by Friday. I'm going to have to go with another style of communication, even though I had this grand plan about how I was going to talk to my crew while walking the floor at Comic-Con. And what a deadline does for me is, as I said, it lops branches off my decision tree. It makes me look at each thing I am looking to complete and ask myself, is this of the essence of the completion or is it ancillary to the essence? Mm-hmm. And so I do a lot of interviewing other people and I always find it terrifying. I sit there while they're talking, terrified, petrified, I'm going to not have a follow-up question, or I'm somehow going to miss some area I wanted to talk about. So I do something similar when I'm interviewing people as I do with any other project, which is I read enough reference material until I sense that I have a point of view about the person that I'm interviewing.
Yeah.
And the moment I have a point of view, then there's all these questions that are general questions that I'm suddenly no longer interested in.
Right.
And sometimes it doesn't even matter to the interviewee. I interviewed Temple Grandin on stage a few years ago.
Oh, nice.
She's an amazing human being. I joke that Jamie Heineman and I are the patron saints of autism spectrum disorder. And my opening for Temple was that if we're the patron saints, she's by all means the Pope. And I realized reading her book and looking at her material and reading stuff and actually speaking to her that she's really dedicated her whole life to alleviating suffering wherever she can find it. And that gave me this great lens with which to frame questions. And in the end, I said that to her in the interview on stage and her response was, sure. And then she moved right on to the next answer. So it wasn't even like that uncovered some deep truth about Temple, but it helped me frame why I was there interviewing her. And that's, it's true. I'm never going to assemble all the questions I want to ask. And frankly, some of the best interviews I've ever done were ones in which I wrote out 65 questions for John Cleese.
Oh my gosh.
And I never looked at a single one because he came so present and so ready to play that we went somewhere totally different.
Yeah.
And I that to me gets really thrilling. I really enjoy that process.
Yeah, I like that process as well. And so these notes, people always go, what are you doing? And I'm like, crossing off things we're naturally getting to anyway without using it. But it helps me navigate and make sure that I'm not like, oh, shoot, I can't believe I forgot to ask about this amazing tip that was the one top thing. Because there'll be something in there that I think about for a week and then go, shit, I didn't ask.
The number of times I've concocted super elaborate questions for someone whose response was, I never thought of it like that. And then we're on to the next thing. And I've thought that we were going to get a real meaty discussion of comedy out of this. And that person has no interest in discussing it.
Yeah. You got to prepare more than you're going to use because nothing's worse than being like, crap, I figured that was a 14-minute block and we are at 32 seconds.
I've had people I've interviewed on stage where I usually do a question per minute. This is a sort of rough outline. Where I had 70 questions for a 60-minute interview, and I used all 70 questions.
Oh, wow.
The interviewee was so not interested in introspection, they made me work really hard.
Yikes, that's brutal. Everyone in the audience is just like, ooh.
There are people who might have been at that interview who know who I'm talking about. That's totally fine.
Yeah, they're still like nursing the beer that they had after that interview, I think.
No, they had a great time.
Yeah.
It just was a lot of heavy lifting for me.
Yeah. That's when you go home and you go, all right, I'm good enough that didn't totally explode in my face.
Yeah, exactly.
You are very self-aware. The book shows this, but in a lot of your interviews, it's really clear that you think a lot about how you think. Mm-hmm. And where does that come from?
I view that as one of our jobs as human beings, to watch ourselves, to watch the watcher and see and learn from the way we're doing things, because we do so many things wrong. I mean, we come to these conclusions about how the world works as we're growing up and we're 5, 6, 7, we're 11, 12, 13. We're making decisions about the chaos we see around us and how to navigate it. And they might be good decisions in the moment, but they're terrible for navigating the rest of life. And yet, as far as I've found, I'm still operating on assumptions that I made when I was between 7 and 16 years old. That introspection comes from a family value. My mom is a psychotherapist. My father was in therapy for his whole life and read deeply about the philosophy of thinking and talked about that. My wife is a therapist. I've been in therapy for most of my life, and I'm a believer that talking and that introspection makes us better. It makes me a better person, a better citizen, a better father, a better husband, a better person. So there's a point in the book where I talk about having taken on a job that was too big for me, not realizing until way too late, not asking for help, ruining somebody's senior thesis film and losing a friend in the process. Mm-hmm. And when I called my dad in the midst of the darkest feeling of that, and he listened to me crying on the phone and feeling like crap and, you know, I can't fix this. I can't make this better. There's nothing I can do. And he said, you can't fix this. You can't make it better. And that's true. And you have to accept that. You can only take this in and learn what it is about you that brought this about to the degree that you're responsible, which is an important thing to rigorously examine, and try not to do it again. And in my family and among the people that I love, that is a value. That is a really important value, to see what you've done, how it didn't work and did work, and try and operate from a place of love and compassion for yourself, which gives you lots of love and compassion for other people. There's that quote at the beginning of Rounders where he says, if you're at a poker table and you can't spot the sucker, you're the sucker.
You're the sucker, yeah.
I've taken that on in life, where if you're driving around and everyone's an asshole, it's you.
Yeah.
That when you're in a bad mood, everyone seems like a jerk. And when you are unhappy with yourself or you're down on yourself, you're much more likely to get down on other people. So to me, that the love and compassion that I'm able to have for other people comes directly from how much I'm able to generate for myself.
The point really hits home. You know, if you go through, I went through a difficult sort of last year business thing. And I remember being like, I don't remember dealing with all these all this bull crap all the time. What is everyone's, and I was like, okay. What would I say to somebody else? What's the common denominator in all these equations? Me, crap. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it's like having that realization early on is super helpful because then you don't wonder why quote unquote life is unfair. You just go, okay, what part am I playing in this and how do I fix it?
Well, and that thing that you just said, getting to understand it early on, it's something that I keep trying to get over because as far as I can tell, life is an endless series of me waking up and going, oh my God, I had no idea that was going on. And it's like combing. I'm at a professional place in my life now where if someone brings me a new project, even if it's in a genre or in a medium, I don't know. If I'm interested in diving in, the process starts out as one of what I call smoothing down the high spots. It's like looking at the totality of the thing until I have a point of view.
Right.
The same thing I was talking about mm-hmm. deadlines. And when I have a point of view, I can start to look and go, okay, there's a problem area because that one sticks out to me as like slightly not fitting with the other stuff. So I sand that down and then I look for another high spot. Now I'm bringing this thing into some, I'm being very abstract here. I recognize.
I think a lot of people understand what you mean, though. Or I understand some totally different point that you're not making. It's also possible.
It's just about the ways in which the things I understand about myself were there's half a dozen things I know about myself now that were mysteries to me 5 years ago. And there's things I understood then that were mysteries to me 5 years before. I cannot believe what an idiot I was 15 years ago.
Oh, I mean, right?
Like it's just appalling.
I think you're supposed to feel that way at every age of your life,
and
right?
And that is, it's really important that we recognize that in any given moment, whatever we think the world is, we're stupid about it. And we're going to learn more, and then we're still going to feel stupid from the vantage point of the future of that future moment. Just because to me, it's an endless set of stairs in the best way. I mean, you know, there's something really, that mission to open my eyes wider and to be more present with the people that are important to me. That's one of the hardest jobs of being a person, and it's the most important one.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Adam Savage. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by Blue Diamond Almonds.
Honey roasted flavored almonds, sriracha flavored almonds, wasabi and soy sauce flavored almonds. Do I have your attention? Why keep snacking on boring chips when you could go to the store and pick up Blue Diamond Almonds right now? Whether you're going to work, bored at work, or leaving work, these almonds are the perfect snack. The best part is I don't hate myself when I eat a bunch like some of those other snacks. What are you waiting for? You know you can listen to a podcast on your way to the store right now, right? So don't deny your cravings. Go pick up some great flavors right now. Eat them. Blue Diamond Almonds. Crave victoriously.
This episode is also sponsored by Experian Boost. A lot of people have been using this recently, and it does make sense to me because, of course, the better your credit score, the easier it is to get stuff that you need. You pay less over time. Little bits in little lower interest rates, like little points, honestly, just single points, can save you thousands or tens of thousands over the course of years. So the question is, of course, why is it so hard to raise your credit score? And the reason is because credit companies, they don't have an incentive to be up to the minute with this, and they've got to be better, sort of a better safe than sorry type of situation. Experian now has Experian Boost, which is a brand new way to instantly increase your credit score. It is free. The reason that this works is because credit scores normally check things like cards, mortgage payments, etc. But for the first time ever with Experian Boost, paying your utilities and your cell phone, which are bills that you have paid over a long time, if you're on time, that should improve your credit score. And so Experian Boost just takes that stuff into consideration. There's no grand wizardry going on here. It gives you credit for the bills you've already been paying through your bank account, water, gas, electric, cable, cell phone, etc. It can usually take months to raise your credit score a point or two. I see mine go up or down one or two points every quarter. With Experian Boost, you can raise your credit score instantly. And again, it's free. It's only from Experian. Jason, tell them how to get this done.
We can't believe it's taken this long for someone to do this. What are you waiting for? Experian Boost can potentially help you establish or increase your access to credit. Boost your FICO score instantly for free. Boost is only available at Experian.com/Jordan. That's Experian.com/Jordan. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And if you're listening to us on the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. We really appreciate it. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Adam Savage.
When you build things, you say you build them in your head and the rest is like cutting the chunks. But walk me through this a little bit, because are you going, okay, I'm going to make this, so I'm going to need this tool, this is the material. I assume you're doing at least that, but how detailed is the visualization? Like, are you thinking like, all right, well, when I'm doing that, I'm tightening that. Ooh, you know what? That's probably going to break because I'm going to have to tighten it enough where that's not going to do it.
There's a lot of that. Well, so I'll give you an example. So you do a podcast. How many podcasts do you do a year?
Like 160.
Okay. So when you think back to the first time you were making a list to make a podcast, you had almost zero institutional knowledge of your own.
Sure.
You were relying on a whole bunch of other people's. But after 50 or 60, and then after a couple of hundred, you build this body of institutional knowledge that understands on a much deeper level than you could have possibly imagined at the beginning about what are the important aspects of this that you really have to button down. You probably in the first few podcasts wasted time taking care of stuff that really doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah.
And you've learned, yeah, that one doesn't matter. That one does. This one matters if we have time, but no one's going to notice if it's not there.
Right.
And those knowing which questions to ask is everything about expertise. And so there becomes a point at which that knowledge becomes almost like a body memory, right? Like you now have this thing where the podcast, instead of a set of separate actions that are overwhelming, it now has this arc to it. Like, okay, I know in the beginning there'll be this, then there'll be this, then there'll be this, then there's the interview, and then there's the stuff after the interview, right? Like, all of a sudden it becomes sort of coalesced like a thing you can almost see in your head. And I think of this like, I had a roommate who was a serious chess player, and I played a few hundred games of chess with him, thinking I was going to get better at chess, and I bought chess tricks and tips and traps and techniques, and I bought books on chess. I bought a chess computer and played chess, and reading about chess and playing a few hundred games taught me I was never going to be a great chess player because no matter how much I tried, the board was still a set of separate actions to be analyzed in and of themselves. And I realized that a real chess player starts to see the board as a gesture, so that they see that gesture and they can actually separate it into the available moves to them, or they can look at it as this thing. And so I submit that in anything one can get to, can become an expert in, that expertise carries with it a kind of a physical understanding of the thing. So I think that it's almost like a plateau you reach with an expertise where, yeah, you can do a lot of the work internally before you lift a tool or a pen or start to actually do research.
I'm
sure if somebody said, you've got to interview Barack Obama and you've got 2 hours, or you've got to interview Barack Obama and you've got 2 months.
Yeah.
Those are going to be two very different lengths of time.
Oh, yeah.
With which to do, but you'd be a lot less afraid of that from the vantage point of 200 podcasts than the vantage point of two.
Yeah.
So all that is an extremely long way of saying, yeah, a lot of my building happens mentally. A lot of the problem solving happens mentally, so that I can get to a point where I can get enough materials in front of me to start to build it for real. And I encounter plenty of problems on the bench that
sure.
I didn't think of in my head. It especially happens when I hit a snag and I can't figure out how to solve a problem. I will let it be, and then I'll go off and I'll think about it for a while. And sometimes I'll think about it for weeks, and then the answer will be like, there it is. And I'll be like, oh my God, what a dummy. Of course, that was the answer all along, and it's totally simple.
Thinking about things like that and then running into these little snags reminds me, when I was an exchange student in Germany in the 90s, I would start to dream eventually in German, and I would wake up in the middle of the night and go, oh, I woke up. Oh, because somebody was talking and then used a word, but I don't know the word. So I would have to keep a dictionary near the bed because I would run into like what you
wow.
have, like a problem, and I'd go,
yeah.
I don't have anything mapped to that. He was going to say, I need to run into the phone booth. And I'm like, how the hell do you say phone booth? And I'd have to look up the word. I'd go back to bed, and my dream would sort of start right around there and then continue.
Fascinating.
So your brain is constantly running into these things when you simulate
Well, and I think that I actually think that the language analogy is a really good one. I think that materials are languages. Building is a language, and the specific materials are words that people don't know. The vocabulary of, you know, I tweeted recently about Chicago screws as a way to hold stuff together, and all these people tweeted back to me, I didn't know what a Chicago screw was. Thank you for that. Because they looked it up, and there it is on Amazon. And if you know the name, it's also called a paper rivet. They're also called blind rivets sometimes, even though that's not the technical term for a blind rivet. And for me, when you know those secret words, you know all of these other solutions. So I love trading those little things. Those, again, they're vocabulary words for making.
Yeah. 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 This is fascinating.
I actually think of it. I came up with the calling it Rumpelstiltskin because I was replicating a prop and I was trying to find this tiny little bottle, and it's made of glass and it's about an inch long. And if you want to search for bottles on Google, the noise to signal ratio is one.
Oh, yeah.
Little bottles. So I thought dram bottles. No. Perfume bottles. No. Perfume samples. No. Apothecary. No. Homeopathy. Every last term I could think of about people who used small bottles, I searched for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then I bought some bottles. I bought lots of old bottles, mm-hmm. so I could look at them and see if any were. And then I started doing research on bottles themselves. This is where I should have actually started this whole process, because I discovered that bottles are classified by the type of lip.
Get out.
Seriously?
Really? That's
so
surprising.
If you want to find a specific type of bottle, you need to first identify the lip type, and then the rest falls into place. And so I looked at the bottle I was trying to find, and it had a specific kind of square lip. It's called a patent lip. And so then I was like, okay, I'd already determined that the bottle held one dram, right? That I made the math right. of the conical interior. I'm sorry, the cylindrical interior. Okay, one dram. So I searched one dram patent lip. Hundreds of results of precisely the bottle I've been looking for months. And once I understood its name, like Rumpelstiltskin, I cracked its spell and it had no power over me.
So satisfying to do.
Oh my God. One of the best things that's ever happened.
And you're like, ooh, eventually AI is going to know what I want, even if I don't know what I want, which will be really useful.
I'm not sure AI is ever going to get that smart.
It would be great though sometimes, but then also terrifying because you're like, how did you know I was out of toilet paper? You're a really, really capable guy. You have a ton of skills. And one thing that this show's done for me is put me around people like you and others on a regular basis. And of course, the problem then with this is that if you're listening to this show or watching this show, it can really seem like, as a listener or a viewer, you're the only person in the world that isn't knocking it out of the park. Like, oh, Jordan's got all these great shows. And then Adam Savage, man, that guy's I am a turd. All I'm doing is I'm becoming a pharmacist. I'm never going to make anything out of my life's so ordinary. Yeah. And it's imposter syndrome.
It's imposter syndrome. It's also what the Buddhists call comparing mind.
And I live there sometimes, and it's such a freaking recipe for disaster.
It is a recipe for disaster, but it's also totally human. So, you know, my shop, while it is a wonderland that I've spent years putting together, I took it apart earlier this year to use all the things in it for the show I just made for the Science Channel. And as such, I put it back together over the last couple months, but it's still not fully flowing. It's still not quite there. So today I was in my shop and I was messing around and it was not going very well. And that happens no matter where you are in your career, no matter who you are, how much success you've had. I think there's this other aspect to it, which is deeply American, which is the scarcity model, which is that everything I'm given would come at a cost to somebody else, or everything someone else has is a cost to me.
Yeah.
But that imposter syndrome, it is so vital to me to talk about it openly and to share stories about it, because nobody escapes it. Every single human you have ever met experiences it all the time. And, you know, on a day-to-day basis, my life does not feel like a productive juggernaut of endless glee.
Yeah.
It is another life like anybody else is living. And I have, you know, wonderful people in my life who I love, and I have difficult people in my life, and I have, you know, trials and tribulations like anybody else. And my tale about imposter syndrome, I was having lunch a few years ago with someone my age, and I mentioned imposter syndrome, and they said, wait a minute, what is that thing you just said? And I said, the feeling that you don't belong where you are, even if you're successful, and that someone's about to come out and tap you on the shoulder and tell you it's time to go home.
Right.
And he just turned sheet white, and he said, I thought it was
home. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it made me so sad that he'd spent 45 years of his life thinking that he was the only one that suffered this and somehow everyone else was escaping it.
Yeah.
And nobody else escapes it. That is, it's just so universal and so important that we talk about that because, you know, I've met people that don't think that they're an imposter and they're interminable to be with.
Well, it's a running theme on the show, the imposter syndrome thing, because of the high performance element of the show. But yeah, if you want to meet somebody who doesn't have imposter syndrome, go talk to a high school freshman or sophomore or senior because they know everything and their life is going to be amazing. But everybody, it's actually the mark of a high performer. If I was in law school and I remember somebody came in and spoke and all these other people that talk about imposter syndrome, but they go to like Harvard, Yale, medical, whatever. And they're like, who here feels like they're the one that slipped through the cracks and it's only a matter of time, and all the hands go up. But if you ask it, yeah, in a room full of people who are not doing much of anything or are really young, they'll be like, what are you talking about? It happens when you are around all of these people who are killing it, because you are probably supposed to be there killing it too. Because it does, in
well,
a way,
because we also live in this, we live in a culture where we love the end of a story being happily ever after.
Well, yeah,
we just assume that. Yeah, that is a very cultural thing, the happily ever after. Oh, you were on TV once. You should be fine and rich forever.
Yes.
And yeah. The answer is no, it doesn't work like that.
And Conan O'Brien actually was talking with Howard Stern about this like last week or about, and it was awesome to hear both of them go, yeah, I pretty much always get mad at myself after a show, or I pretty much always think, oh, I should have done this again, or I should have done this a different way.
You feel like you leave money on the table.
Yeah.
It's never done. It's never complete. And frankly, every single time I have experienced the emotion, oh man, I've got this wired, life was rearing up with a big fat open hand to smack me across the face with humility and disaster.
Yeah.
Every last time. It's uncanny.
I know that your father did some Sesame Street Muppeteer.
He did not do Muppeteer. This is a thing I cannot.
It's freaking on Wikipedia.
I can't get it off my Wikipedia page.
Muppeteer, do they? Like, that's Muppets.
I've asked people to remove it. I've pulled it. I've flagged it. My dad was not a Muppeteer.
Okay.
My dad was an animator. And when Sesame Street started in the late 60s, early 70s, their axiom was 1/3 puppets, 1/3 live action, and 1/3 animation. And this was groundbreaking for a kid's show, as it was and still continues to be. And my dad was one of the very first animators they hired.
Oh,
and so he raised us doing animated interstitials on Sesame Street. He did about 2 or 3 a year through all of the 70s.
And how did he encourage you to be creative? And by the way, it's going to be off your Wikipedia after this, because I think you saying, hey, that's wrong, is
we'll
gonna,
see.
Like, we'll
I've
see
mentioned
though.
It before.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. How did he encourage you to be creative?
Watching him paint every day imbued me with the understanding that this thing had a value and a really abiding and life affirming value to him. And I mean, he was by no means uncomplicated, and it was a very chaotic childhood that I had. But that example of someone painting every single day, someone who put that much value onto this weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I submit that almost all the thing that everything that we do, everything we do as a hobby, everything that we have to do is a weird hobby. I mean, fishing is weird when you think about it.
Oh, I agree with
they
that.
They don't have to be utilitarian.
Yeah.
And so every time I explored, you know, making something, my parents were encouraging about it. They liked it. They did not, again, it's encouragement. You know, telling your kid when he's starting to sing that he's singing off key is a really, really shitty thing to do to a kid. You've got to let people have an open space with which to try and iterate and what they might think of as failing in order to find whether or not they're going to love that thing. And my parents definitely gave me that.
You have twin sons. How are you encouraging them to create without putting unhealthy pressure on them? And I worry because I've got my new baby coming soon, and
yeah,
I put unhealthy pressure on myself. So it's going to be really hard not to put it on other people who I love.
I resolved very early to put the things they were interested in front of them and make the materials and things that they were curious about available to them. So, I bought a lot of drum sets and guitars and things that didn't get used, but I also bought a lot that did. My kids are both very accomplished musicians. They're kind people, but it's not like I did, honestly, I mean, I don't know if it's the frame of this question, which tends to carry the assumption that I may have done something right, is still not something I'm convinced of. Raising children is a lifelong exercise. And even though my boys are 20, I'm still smack in the middle of it.
Yeah.
I try to speak to them openly. I try to, in my whole family, work hard to understand the family dynamics. There are dynamics between me and my kids. There are dynamics between each of us and our families, both our parents and our partners and our kids, that we can even know about and might not be able to change. But just knowing about them so that you can talk about them and you can normalize these experiences is really, really important.
I was talking with Penn Jillette on the show before. And he had mentioned, I thought, oh, well, you work with this other guy, Teller, for a long time. You guys must be really close. And he was like, no, we are not friends.
No.
And I actually heard that similar to them, you and Jamie were not are not friends. And I'm surprised, but I get it also because I've been through that similarly. I guess we just assume if we see people together all the time, they have to be getting along.
Yeah. It's not. It actually is and I think Penn and Teller are both good friends. And they would say the same thing that Jamie and I would say, which is there's a real strength to a partnership that's not, that doesn't have an emotional component. We're not afraid to hurt each other's feelings, which means we're not afraid to go to the carpet on, you know, go to mat on the things that we think about each other. When we think someone's being full of shit, we'll say it. And consequently, that relationship's one of the most satisfying relationships I have had with Jamie. We fought about the small stuff constantly. But we really never fought about the big, we never fought about the big stuff. We never fought about turning down large sums of money to bust myths about somebody's product or other. And the lack of the emotional component, yeah, it was a real strength because of the fact that we could concentrate on what's in front of us better.
Yeah. This makes sense.
I mean, it's also one based on a deep amount of respect. So while Penn and Teller aren't necessarily two people who would go out to dinner together, although, you know, you end up sharing a lot of meals with your business partner. And the same thing is true for me and Jamie. We've never had dinner alone together in the 30 years.
It's just so crazy. When I heard that, I was like, how can that be the case?
But the respect that I have, knowing that Jamie would have been able to get this bill done by the end of the day, no matter what I think of the technique he's about to dive into, that respect is really paramount. So, you know, the difficulties we had were never based on a lack of respect for each other. And we never lashed out and were insulting with each other. We fought bitterly about stuff, but it never got personal.
Yeah.
And that's really important because also when your business partners with someone, like it or not, you're going to be intimate in their lives in a way that's abiding and deep, even if they're not your friend. Jamie and I know things about each other's lives that few other people in our lives know. We've shared that over those decades.
I can imagine companies coming at you, speaking of turning down large sums of money, like, all right, make sure we're going to bust the myth that Bronny isn't the toughest paper towel.
Yep.
And you're like, no, I'm going to not sleep at night.
Early on, we would get these and we realized, wow, so basic cable is that you don't get residuals. So we got paid for making Mythbusters and we never make another penny from the enterprise. Which is fine. That's the rules. Yeah. That's how those contracts go. But it also means that the only thing I have when Jamie and I realized this early, the only thing we would have when we finished was our integrity. And that was a coin not to be spent unwisely.
Sure.
Because, you know, you could just become Bob Vila and you could become what I consider kind of a joke about making stuff because, you know, there was a period of time when it seemed like there was not a product he wouldn't stump for. So I have no idea what to believe. He just seems like a product endorser.
Yeah.
I haven't deeply researched Bob Vila. He's probably a lovely man, and I don't mean to insult him.
He seems like a nice guy.
I'm merely talking about the fictional Bob Vila that is a cultural symbol in my head. I don't mean to insult the actual human being.
That loves everything that Kmart produces or whatever it was.
We realized that we were going to do that if it mattered to us and if we believed in what we were doing, then we would take the money and we would do a thing about somebody's product.
Yeah.
And we did a lovely one for Corning, wanted to do this set of videos called A Day of Glass. And it was one of the most delightful things because Corning is such a fantastic company and everything you could think of to do with glass, they kind of invented it starting back in the 19th century. It was like this unfettered
easy decision to make, because it's like, well, there's no problem with this company at all. There's no hidden skeletons. They didn't build Nazi warships or something like that. And this is awesome.
Yeah. Or they just did a really awesome cover up. No one's ever going to crack it open.
Exactly.
Because you couldn't find it. The show, I was looking for like interesting tidbits about the show, and there's stuff in there like a woman saved her own life and that of her infant because she had fallen into a ditch.
Underwater car.
Yeah, the underwater car. And then I found some way that you guys had accidentally found a really easy way to make an explosive out of a very common chemical and ended up like censoring that and then telling DARPA, the Defense Department, essentially.
Yep. And they were like, yeah, we know about that. Thank you for not telling anybody.
Yeah, thanks for not putting on a really popular cable show. But the one that really stuck out was the cannonball accident.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the cannonball accident? That's one where I bet you were, your whole, every sphincter in your body was clenched at max while you waited for the outcome of that.
It was awful. So it happened out at the Alameda County Sheriff's bombing range where a cannon was being fired to test its exit, the speed of the cannonball. And there were a bunch of safety procedures put in place, but it was hard to, Jamie and I had fired cannons into the same hill before. And we'd used this basically, 200 foot tall mountain, this tiny hill, as a backstop for cannon shots before. However, when this cannon was being shot, it was in the middle of the 6-year drought that that Northern California had. And so this hill, far from receiving the cannonball, was hard as a rock. And the cannonball bounced off the hill, flew a mile into Dublin, California, and bounced off a sidewalk, went up through the lintel of this man's house, passed through the bedroom of his sleeping wife and child.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Flew another 1,000 feet, landed on the roof of somebody else's house, broke some tiles off of it, bounced into the passenger seat of an SUV that had been parked there 5 minutes before. And nobody was hurt. Now, we started to get calls immediately. I got a call within an hour from Australia. And it taught me this. The first lesson I learned from this is that no reporter you've ever done an interview with has ever thrown out your number.
Yeah.
They're ready to call you if they have that access. Number two is that the story that's going to have the most traction is the one people are secretly expecting. And the story from Mythbusters of the idea of an experiment gone wrong and someone getting hurt, it just was like this perfect dovetail of people's secret desire for Mythbusters because it seems kind of dangerous. So shouldn't something dangerous happen at some point with the like, oh my God, that totally happened. So then, the very first thing Jamie and I wanted to do was head out there and talk to the people whose property and their safety felt compromised by this accident. And we wanted to apologize to them. So we did. And we apologized to all the people this happened to. We made good on restoring their home and their homes and their property to better than it was before. Each of the people we talked to requested that whatever safety procedures we had in place, we make them more robust. Yeah. And that is an absolutely reasonable request. And we promised them that. And in fact, those safety procedures are still ones that I follow today in production. Luckily, we learned that without anyone having to get hurt. And then we walked out of the house of one of the people whose house was hurt by the cannonball to a press conference. And I have never experienced this before. 20 microphones sitting there in a big holder, and this bank of reporters with their trucks all ready with questions. And my brain did this really funny thing. I'm walking out towards this and I'm thinking, oh, look at that holder for all those microphones. It's this big chunk of aluminum, about 1/2 inch thick with radiused edges and a port for all these different microphones. That is a machine shop built that thing.
Yeah.
They built it for that purpose. It can't be a big market. It can't be a huge market. It's got to be this limited thing. It's probably going to cost like $1,200. So every news, I started wondering, literally all the way walking, I'm thinking this, does every news truck have one? And whose do they use for any given press conference? Is it the first guy to show up? The first person? So I'm just like sort of, one of my ways of relaxing is looking at things and imagining how they got built. Like imagining the first meeting, the design meeting, the iterations, the process, the manufacturing, et cetera. And this was no different. So then I stand up at the mic, Jamie and I stand, and people are like, the reporters are asking. At first, it's this very cacophonous, blah, 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 what's that? Okay, what's your question? How did that guy feel about it? Okay. And we started to answer questions, and we were answering them honestly. There was nothing to hide here. We had nothing to obfuscate. This mistake was made on our watch. We were responsible and we were taking that responsibility. And within like six questions, the whole energy became like diffused to the point of like, it became a real quiet press conference and people asked like three or four more questions. Then everyone was like shrugged and went like, all right, I think we got what we need.
Yeah.
And it was another lovely lesson that to make a story not like both Jamie and I, actually all five of us, Carrie, Grant, Tori, Jamie, I, our production team, our producers, our production company, all of us were mortified by this. And this is, for us, the darkest day of Mythbusters.
Yeah, I mean, you could have killed a woman and a child with a cannonball.
It was awful. Absolutely awful. And we're still, you know, if I am talking to a large audience and someone says cannonball and people laugh, I tell the story as a way of saying there's nothing funny about that. I get the humor and I get how that humor dovetails with your vision of Mythbusters. But the fact is nothing was funny about it. And we weren't treating it as something we were trying to hide, obfuscate, or divest responsibility of. And that meant that, you know, the reporters were like, all right, I guess that's about it.
Yeah. All right. So you tell me about this Iron Man suit, because I know this is coming up, but like this thing is next level.
It's totally insane. So this is for this new show I have called Savage Build. It starts airing on June 12th on the Science Channel after BattleBots. And we were in production on this show from January through April of this year. And the very first episode, we built a working suit of Iron Man armor out of 3D printed titanium. Kevin Feige, the head of the Marvel group, gave me personal permission to get the original computer files of the Iron Man Mark II suit from Shane Mahan at Legacy Effects, the guys that have built all the Iron Man suits and made tons of incredible armor costumes, for the Marvel and countless other films. And we worked with the Colorado School of Mines, which is in Mines with an N. Yeah. It's an incredible engineering school.
Not mimes.
Not mimes. Yeah. Everyone makes that joke. An incredible engineering school. And the best part about it was it just grew out of me having done an appearance at the School of Mines and them saying, hey, we've got this whole new additive manufacturing department. They literally built an entire building to teach kids about additive manufacturing, 3D printing. And they said, we just got this new titanium printer. Got anything you want to make with it? And when we were in pre-production on the show, I was like, maybe we should make some Iron Man armor. And I called them up. And EOS, the makers of that machine, donated all the 3D printing, which is good because it was well over $250,000 worth of printing. But the end result is, if Tony Stark became non-fictional, if you could wave a magic wand and Iron Man needed to make a suit, this is the process by which he would start. We made, I consider, a working prototype of an Iron Man armor suit. It is bulletproof.
Sweet.
There is some flying
involved.
Did
you test that?
It was so much fun and such a wonderful thing to dive all into this fantasy. Oh, because it turns out that plate titanium has a certain kind of strength. But if you 3D print it, you're actually laser sintering layers of powder titanium onto previous layers. And this means that you can use the lasers to attenuate the internal crystalline grain structure of the titanium and make it much stronger than normal titanium.
What?
So it's even like, I didn't know that when we started, but by the end of the episode, we were like, yeah, this is not a fantasy armor. This is a working prototype of the fantasy armor made real.
How do you know it's bulletproof?
You'll have to watch the episode.
Okay,
and
I assume how do you know it flies is also
that. I've got to leave something on the
hey, I'm
something
in.
For people to tune into and watch.
I'm in. Thank you very much. It's been
my absolute pleasure. It was delightful.
So Jason, the Mythbusters guy, I remember talking about getting Adam Savage on like 5 years ago or something like that. I don't know. Finally, we got around to doing it.
Yeah, I used to see Adam all the time when I lived in San Francisco, and I was always like, man, I want to go up and say hi, but I was like, he's with his kids, and I'm like, okay, don't do that thing. Don't be that guy. But I would always like kind of like give him a little salute and a wink, and he would always do it back. He knew the deal. So a very smart guy.
That is cool. I often wonder how I'll be with kids, because at some level, when the kids are little, yeah, you don't really want to be disturbed. But when they're like 10 to 20 or older, yeah, you kind of want them to think you're cool. So it'd be awesome if someone comes up and is like, hey, Jordan, oh my God, I'm a huge fan. Because then you're with your kid and you're like, hey, some people actually think your dad's pretty cool. And then after that, after they get older, then you don't want to be bothered again. So I'm interested to see what the phases of being a parent and having essentially strangers come up and say hi to you
is going to be like for me.
The kid's not even born yet, and you're already thinking about getting your dad cred. Come on, man.
You got to. I just remember how lame I thought my dad was for a really long time, and it was like embarrassing to be with my parents. But when I was little, I thought he was really cool, and now that I'm older, I think he's pretty cool. But in the meantime, yeah, anybody who tried to tell me my dad was cool, it was just in one ear and out the other, and it's probably going to be the same thing. Like, I bet you there's got to be a point at which even, like, Jaden Smith is like, ugh, I don't want my dad to go. It's like, dude, your dad's Will Smith. You're good.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, I know my dad's Will Smith. I grew up with him. I'm tired of it.
That's the problem. I don't want to hear the dad jokes, the corny BS. I mean, you know, it's got to be just a universal thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yeah. Great big thank you to Adam Savage. The book title is Every Tool is a Hammer. Well, links to his stuff, of course, will be in the show notes. And if you want to know how we book these great people and create all these great connections, it's all about the network. It's all about that warm introduction. It's all about that good word. And we're teaching you how to create networks for personal or professional reasons in 6-minute networking. That's our course. It's free. It's at jordanharbinger.com/course. Don't wait. Don't kick the can down the road. You've got to dig the well before you get thirsty. I get so many letters in my inbox that are like, hey, didn't dig the well. Now I need a job. What do I do? And I don't want to be callous, but my response is often, you dug this grave, you lay in it kind of thing. But I know that that doesn't help somebody who's unemployed and goes, I knew I should have done this. But don't be that person who's in my inbox going, I wish I'd done this 10 years ago and now I'm broke. That's not good. And it happens more often than I think any of us would like to admit. And by the way, most of the guests on the show actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter, which you get when you sign up for the course. And I don't mail out every day or anything. It's like every other week at best. You can find it all at jordanharbinger.com/course. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Adam Savage. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. There's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason Mythbusted DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every single episode. So please share the show with those you love, and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time. A lot of you out there like to build your network. There's actually a show called Build Your Network with my friend Travis Chappell. It's dedicated to helping people level up their inner circle, build meaningful connections the right way, and ultimately become a better version of themselves. And Travis, who hosts the show, he walks the walk, man. I mean, he's a great guy, kind of a new-ish friend of mine last couple of years, and he's always thinking about how to help other people, get in touch with people. I mean, he's really putting some brain power towards this stuff, and he's gunning for the guests. He's got highly valuable and practical advice from some of the best leaders in the world, including Shark Tank panelists, an FBI hostage negotiator. I'll give you a hint who that might be. Several New York Times best-selling authors, billionaires, investors, and more. Like I said, he's going for it, man. He started less than 2 years ago, and now he's got over 275 episodes featuring some of the world's top leaders. And remember, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. I've said that on the show a bunch. You've heard it elsewhere. So search for Build Your Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and start leveling up your inner circle today. The show and its guests have a lot of value, and I think you'll enjoy it. You can also find him at travischappell.com/show. We'll link to that in the show notes.